Alan asks. I'll sit elsewhere if... No, of course not. Sit, please. He does, and we dig into our meals. As we eat, I keep glancing over at Logan, but one second he's deep in conversation, and the next he's gone. I'll catch up with him later and explain what happened with the Aberzombies. For now, I enjoy a very satisfying meal and equally satisfying conversation. Holly is totally cool, and Alan, well, I'm reminded of why I chose him for my first kiss. He's as friendly and sweet as I remember, and he makes what could be a horribly awkward situation smooth and easy. After dinner, it's time for small group sessions. While the conference is about fostering interracial relationships, they also want to give attendees a chance to chat within their own races about problems specific to them. That's great, except that it means Logan and I will be talking to each other. At least it gives me a chance to discuss an issue we might currently be facing after my impulse control failure at the buffet table. I go in search of my brother. That's my plan anyway. But as I'm leaving, I notice Elijah up ahead, telling another half-demon to start without him. The chicken didn't agree with his stomach and he needs a restroom pit stop. That alone wouldn't get my attention, especially when he does indeed pop into the restroom. But then I get stalled talking to Trisha for a few seconds, and as I'm breaking away, Elijah is already slipping from the restroom. He casts a furtive look around and jogs off in the other direction. Apparently, someone is ducking the small group sessions. Not wanting a repeat performance from earlier, I hang back to avoid him. He pauses at the stairs going down to the first level, and his tensing shoulders warn me he's about to turn. I flatten myself into the recessed doorway, but he only glances around. Then his footsteps continue on, past the stairs, heading into a hall clearly marked staff only. I give a quick look around. Then I follow.
Chapter 9. Logan. In my quest to find Mason, I ask a few people whether they've seen him. Of course, I first need to introduce myself. As I slog through the, "Hey, you're new, what race are you? Oh, a secret, huh?" I find myself wishing I could be more like Kate, who'd plow past the small talk in a situation like this. Two campers don't know who Mason is. Another two curl their lips and say that thankfully they haven't seen him, and then they launch into a speech about what a jerk he is. Clearly, this is not a shortcut to finding my erstwhile roommate. The obvious answer is to track Mason by scent, and I return to our room to pick up his trail. His scent tells me he walked to the stairs, turned and headed out the door, then veered left. I spot a storage shed in that direction, jog over and bend to check. His trail continues inside. The door has a padlock, but it's been left ajar. I push it open. This is a more traditional camp building. It even has windows, and I step into a quiet, still space that smells of fresh wood and canvas. There's not much in the shed, and all of it is new, bought for this conference. Tents, mostly, along with maybe a dozen sleeping bags. Presumably, there's a small group camping component to the conference. I'll have to tell Kate. She'll like that. The tents and sleeping bags have been numbered so recently I can still smell the Sharpie fumes. One of each is missing. At the empty spot, I detect Mason's scent. I could drop the matter here. If solo tent camping is against rules, that's no concern of mine. I certainly won't tattle on him. Yet, this isn't a state park campground. We're deep in the Appalachian foothills, and if you don't have a werewolf's tracking ability, it'd be easy to get lost. I smelled black bear earlier, and that won't be the only predator out there. Mason isn't a little kid. If he makes stupid choices, that's on him. But if he's made a stupid choice because of me, I need to be exactly the kind of guy I suspect he despises. The overgrown Boy Scout compelled to warn him of the forest's dangers. I follow his trail from the shed. As I do, I glance at the conference center. It's as silent as when we arrived. They should be out here, enjoying a late spring evening where they can make as much noise as they want with no one to disturb. Instead, they're locked up in a windowless box. This can't be what Paige intended. Until she arrives, though, being alone out here is to my advantage. There's no one to stop me from slipping into the forest. Tracking Mason is easier outdoors where I don't have to worry about someone spotting me with my nose in the dirt. I don't snuffle along like a bloodhound. Mason has followed a rough path into the forest, and I only need to drop every 10 paces or so and make sure he hasn't left it. When he does, a half mile from camp, I can follow the trail of broken twigs and trampled undergrowth. After that, I smell him on the breeze. He went maybe 50 feet off trail before he found a suitable clearing and erected his tent. Or, I should say, he attempted to erect it. The structure lists to one side, and it'll collapse once he's in it. Clearly, Mason is not a guy with extensive camping experience. Sitting on a log is the wannabe survivalist himself. He's eating a granola bar, water bottle in hand, his gaze down. When I approach, he doesn't even look up as he says, "Turn around and go back, mutt." "I'm not a mutt. I'm a pack werewolf." He snorts.
"Yeah, that's right. You're a werewolf prince. Can't mistake you for one of the plebes."
Prince would imply a hereditary leadership, which we don't have. Admittedly, we do have an archaic system, though given that we refer to non-pack werewolves as mutts, which is meant to be as insulting as you implied, Mom would like to get rid of that word, but there's resistance even among those it refers to, especially among those, actually. They see it as a badge of honor.
"Did you come out here to discuss werewolf politics?"
"We could," I say as I lower myself to the ground. "It's a favorite topic of mine." He finally looks at me, then, as if to see whether I'm kidding, he catches my eye, snorts again, and shakes his head.
"Go away, Teen Wolf," he says. "Is that more politically correct?"
I'm not sure politically correct is the right term, but...
"Fuck off, Logan Danvers. Better?"
I wrap my arms around my knees. "It is. And the answer is, no thank you. I understand the request, and I decline to comply." His face hardens. Then he looks at the forest behind me.
"How'd you find me?"
I arch a brow. "I'm a werewolf. I track scents." He nods, slowly, as if assimilating this. "I'm sure you realize that," I say. "What you actually meant was how did I track you when you shouldn't have a scent?"
"Of course I have one. Everyone does. Not vampires."
There's a split-second delay. Then he takes a big bite of his bar, teeth bared as he rips it off, chews, swallows, and pitches the rest at me.
"Check the wrapper," he says. 100% plasma-free.
I take out the last piece and pop it into my mouth.
"Hey,"
Mason says. "I missed dinner. You wouldn't happen to have more, would you?" I sniff the air, rise, and find a stash beside the tent. I grab one and rip it open.
"Thanks. That's my food, asshole."
"I think we already established that you're worried about me getting hungry. I don't want to scare you with my grumbling stomach. So, you're a vampire. Interesting."
"Did you just see me eat that bar?"
"Vampires can eat food. They just prefer not to because they have trouble digesting it, being dead."
"Do I look dead? Do I smell dead?"
"You are very pale, and you have that brooding vamp persona down pat. If you're trying to hide your racial identity, you might want to act more cheerful. However, you do have a scent, and that stash of granola bars suggests you eat voluntarily, not just to fit in with humans.
Weird, huh? It's almost like I'm...
He meets my gaze.
Not a vampire.
True, except you are, which makes this very odd. He glowers at me.
I've heard of people being smarter than they sound, but you're the first person I've met who sounds smarter than he is. Let me guess, private school?
See, here's the logical conundrum I'm trying to work out. You have a scent, you eat food, your heart beats, you clearly are not dead, yet I can tell you're a predator, and the only two supernatural predators are vampires and werewolves. I suppose I might not be aware of some minor predatory race, but that's highly unlikely. Mason rolls his eyes.
Because you've read the Encyclopedia Britannica of supernatural races cover to cover.
There is no such thing. However, I've read most of the Interracial Council's library, which I'd never rule out the possibility of a third predatory race. They'd be exceptionally rare. And the counselors know all about yours. They also commented on the danger of putting us in a room together. As predators, vampires and werewolves are naturally wary of one another. But it isn't the historical animosity of sorcerers and witches. I suspect the counselors have seen too many movies if they presume we're natural enemies.
Or, I'm not a goddamn vampire.
Vampires aren't damned by God. They're just another hereditary evolution. He glowers at me. I continue. Vampires are the only race that other supernaturals hate and fear as much as werewolves. The counselor's comments suggest you and I fall into the same category. Ergo, since I can tell you're not a werewolf, by process of elimination, you must be a vampire.
A breathing, eating, not dead vampire.
Mason shakes his head and pushes to his feet.
Enough of this bullshit.
He unzips his tent and reaches in, grabbing his sleeping bag as if to start packing. One of the tent pegs wobbles.
Watch!
I begin. The tent collapses on him. I could help. That'd be the nice thing to do, but that would mean I'd miss out on the scene of Mason cursing and batting his arms with the tent draped over him. At least I'm polite enough to avoid laughing. Or avoid laughing loud enough for him to hear over his curses. He staggers about, scrambling to get free, the tent draped squarely over his head. When he heads straight for the log, I leap up to catch him before he trips.
Get your paws off me! He roars.
I let go. He falls face first to the ground. More cursing. I helpfully tug the tent off his head. Blood streams from his nose. He swipes it and lifts his hand to me.
Not a vampire, he says.
Vampires can bleed if they've just fed, I said. That might also explain the scent. I believe they have one if they've recently...
For fuck's sake, I'm not a vampire!
Then what are you? He puts his face inches from mine.
None of your business.
Mason kicks the tent aside. Then he stomps to a backpack, hefts it, and stalks into the forest. Don't forget your tent, I call.
It's all yours. I'm going back to camp.
I munch on another granola bar as his footsteps recede in the wrong direction. I continue eating. Mason continues crashing through the brush. I polish off the rest of the bar. Then I rise, brush crumbs from my shorts, and start fixing his tent in case he returns. Otherwise, I'll go after him to make sure he gets back to camp. I'm just not in a hurry. If he gets lost and starts to panic, that brick wall might drop enough for me to find out.
What the?
Mason's voice rises, shrill, from deep in the woods. Then he bellows in pain. The sound cut short. The forest falls silent. I drop a tent peg and run.
Chapter 10. Kate. Earlier, as we came upstairs for dinner, Holly said the other end of the hall belonged to the counselors. Bedrooms, mostly. That's where Elijah's heading. You messing around with a counselor, Elijah? Technically none of my business, but you've piqued my curiosity. And I could use a little blackmail ammo in case you decide to continue your weird performance art with me. He doesn't glance over his shoulder again, which seems odd. He was obviously being so careful before. Yet, when my shoe scuffs the floor, he freezes. He turns then, but I'm still back by the stairs, where I can easily duck out of sight. I'm surprised he heard that. Sound must really echo down here. It's definitely quiet. Also, bright and sunny with a skylight ceiling. I'm envying the counselor's bedroom space until I realize that they'll be up at the crack of dawn, blasted awake by spring sunshine. Maybe my den-like main floor bedroom isn't so bad after all. I track Elijah's footfalls. A doorknob turns with a squeak. A hard jangle, and the door creaks open on new and stiff hinges. Another creak, followed by a soft click as the door shuts. If he's rendezvousing with a counselor, I definitely don't want to hear that. But if I can ID his hookup, that's a pellet of blackmail ammo to tuck in my back pocket. The left side of the hall seems to be bedrooms. On the right, the first door is labeled storage. A thunk comes from farther down the hall, still on my right. There's one more door on that side. I reach it and read the sign. Office. Another thunk, like a desk drawer closing. Elijah's rifling through the office. Huh. Now that's more interesting than hooking up with a counselor. There's a keyhole, but the door's unlocked. I ease it open a crack. Elijah has his back to me. He is indeed rifling through a desk, and somehow I don't think he's looking for a pen. As I watch, he finishes checking drawers. Whatever he's searching for, he can tell at a glance it's not there. He's moving fast enough that I don't think he expects to find it. He's just checking. When he zeroes in on the desktop computer, I nod in understanding. If I had to guess, I'd say he'd been looking for papers, seeking information that would be easier to get at than computer files. The 20-something staff aren't going to keep much on paper, though. Elijah flicks on the monitor. The computer pops to life with a login screen. He grunts and flips up the keyboard and then checks behind the monitor, looking for a conveniently placed password. I push open the door and he jumps, spinning. Found you! I chirp as I sail in. I waggle a forefinger. You are playing hard to get. He stares at me. Then he gives a strangled, what? I stop in front of him and bounce on my toes. I looked for you at dinner, and I saw you with those girls. Another finger waggle. You better not be one of those guys.
One of
a player. I pronounce the word like a private school kid who's never said it before. Hitting on all the single ladies because you? I step closer and grab him by the shirt front. Are mine. He backpedals, and I release him with a giggle. Kidding. I won't manhandle you. Not yet, at least. I give an exaggerated wink.
I don't understand.
You made it very clear earlier that you were into me, and I have decided the answer is yes. Let's do this thing.
Do
hook up, or at least make out. He arches his brows, just arches them, an unspoken question that he thinks he knows the answer to, but he's not guessing in case he's wrong. Player? I said, drawling the word in my usual voice, that chipper squeal gone.
I don't know what you're talking about, he says, but his eyes twinkle. You played me. I played you back. Now, can we move on? Or do we want to neg each other a bit more first? His brows knit. Neg? Flirting with me while pointing out my flaws to make me want to convince you that I'm good enough to date. There's a name for that shit? He shakes his head. I've seen guys do it, and I just figured they were really bad at picking up girls. You weren't trying to hit on me, I said. You were trying to scare me off, so I wouldn't follow you and see what you're up to. One split second of confusion, followed by a wide grin. You got me. Liar. My explanation makes no sense, and he was far too quick to jump on it. Interesting. I'll drop it for now. I need more info before I figure out what he'd really been up to with this afternoon's performance. What are you doing in here? I ask. He shrugs, that overly nonchalant kind of shrug that precedes another fib. Trying to get online, you know? They confiscated our phones, and I'm in a band, and we just posted our video to YouTube. I wanted to check our lacks. Band, huh? What do you play? Drums. What's in your trap set? He gives me this lopsided grin. Four-piece, mostly. Kick drum, snare, two rack toms, plus cymbals. I'll mix it up, but I'm fond of my four-piece. Keeps things simple. A knowing look. Did I pass the test? I give a grudging nod. He leans against the desk. I'm guessing you're a drummer. I play a few instruments. All the loud ones. He laughs at that. And his eyes. God, he has gorgeous eyes. I step back, telling myself I'm escaping the lingering cloud of body spray. I'll accept that you might play the drums, I say. You might even be in a band. I am in a band. Comatose Honeymoon. And believe me, I couldn't make that name up. Maybe. But you aren't sneaking into this office looking for internet access to check your video stats. He sighs. You're going to turn this into a serious conversation, aren't you? Guess that means we aren't making out. Depends on whether you tell me the truth. He gives a sharp bark of a laugh. So that's my incentive? Potential bonus. He laughs again, his eyes on mine, warm and open. Then a look passes behind them, almost like regret, and he straightens. As tempting as that might be, whatever I was doing, it's my business, and... His head jerks up. I catch footsteps. I should have heard them first, and I kick myself. Apparently, those eyes and that smile distracted me, which is insanely embarrassing. My consternation lasts a split second before I look for a place to hide. There isn't one. No closets, no back exits, no filing cabinet big enough to hide behind. I grab Elijah's arm and yank him toward the door. The footsteps are still a ways off. I peek into the hall. No one's in sight. I push Elijah out and follow, shutting the door behind us. When I turn, he's looking down the corridor, his lips parting in a shit that tells me we don't have time to duck out the way we came. I glance in the other direction, but the hall ends 10 feet away. Still, I grab his hand and pull him in that direction. He resists. That's a dead end. I yank harder, hauling him along after me. Then I spin him around, pushing his back into the corner as I lace my hands behind his neck. We're face to face for a heartbeat before his eyes close and his lips move toward mine. When I don't follow, his eyes fly open. Oh, he whispers. You didn't mean we should... I didn't. I'd figured putting my arms around his neck would be enough of a hint about what was going on to fool whoever is about to see us. But I shrug and murmur, "Sure, why not?" and lift up to kiss him, pausing at the last second to be sure he's game. His lips meet mine just as the person must step into the hall, because sneakers squeak and a female voice says, "Oh." I fully intended to stop there. The person approaching will see us and say something, and we'll leap apart with a fake startled yelp and then sheepishly slip past her. Except Elijah doesn't stop. He pulls me to him, his mouth on mine, kiss deepening. The newcomer retreats with a tapping of footfalls. I have no idea where she goes. I'm a little too busy to notice. Elijah's lips are on mine. His breath is sweet as fresh hay. There's a moment where I realize that's a really weird analogy, but the thought only flits past, banished by the kiss. The kiss. Hell and damn. It's a kiss that makes me wonder whether I've been doing it wrong all this time. His hands rest in the hollow just above my hips, his fingers encircling my waist, and there's a sturdiness there. Again, that's a weird word to use, but it's what it feels like. As if he's planted his hands there, firmly gripping me, to say this is where his fingers will stay, that they aren't going to suddenly inch toward another destination. I wrap my arms around his neck, and the kiss goes deeper still. I close my eyes, as I swear I smell the tang of grass and trees. Taste sharp water, fresh from a cold stream. Hear the sigh of wind in trees as I smell beyond his horrible body spray to a deep musk that lights my insides on fire. My blood pounds as if I'm running, as if we're both in the forest and running. And within that sighing wind, I hear the pant of a wolf at my side. The pound of paws, a soft growl, the musky smell of Elijah enveloping me and... holy shit. I yank back, breaking the kiss. And I stare into his eyes. I blink. Then, before he can react, I bury my nose in the crook of his neck, inhale sharply and breathe. Werewolf.
Chapter 11. Logan. I run in the direction of Mason's bellow. I've been shouting for him, but I've heard nothing. Nothing at all. It must be an animal attack. A bear, because I can't imagine anything else out here big enough to hurt him into silence. No, that's not true. The even more likely answer is human. I'm just struggling to wrap my head around that because these woods feel so empty. Nick had driven miles down an empty road. On the mile walk to camp, we saw no sign of anyone else out here. If it is a person who attacked Mason, what could they have done to make him cry out in pain and then fall silent? I'd have heard a gunshot. If he was attacked with another kind of weapon, I should have heard more. A single blow could knock him out, but he wouldn't have had time to bellow in pain first. A bear doesn't seem like the answer either. Any animal attack, again, would take longer. Mason's bigger than me. A 300-pound black bear could kill him, but not so quickly. So, what? I break, suddenly, and my feet twist. In a year, I've shot up 4 inches and put on 30 pounds. Operating my new body is like playing a familiar video game with a new controller. Just when I think I've gotten the hang of it, I try to stop and nearly trip over my own feet. I drop to one knee before I catch myself, poised there in a sprinter's starting position, hands on the ground as I lift my nose to sample the air. And when I don't smell him, my eyes narrow. I stopped because I've realized the answer to my problem. There is no logical solution to the puzzle of what attacked him. The answer, then, is nothing. Nothing attacked him. Mason is playing me. What I heard was horror movie fodder. An exclamation, a scream cut short as the monster rips out its victim's heart. Mason strode into the forest and enacted a horror movie's sudden death scene, one guaranteed to bring any decent person running. I've already proven I'd fall for it, having tracked him into the woods to make sure he's okay. Such a chump. Easy prey for an asshole like Mason. Whatever Mason's plan, I'm prepared, and I'm going to flip this on him. He's the one who'll learn a lesson. I should change forms, give him a real scare, show him exactly what kind of risk he takes by threatening me. As I realize what I'm thinking, I stop short. Sure, change forms, and then, if he attacks, I'll defend myself with fangs and claws. Lethal fangs and claws. I shiver and fight against the rage pulsing through me. If I'm this angry now, I definitely can't afford to change. I need to rein in my temper and confront Mason as a human. I rise, rolling my shoulders as I slough off my anger. I sniff the air again. There is a faint scent of Mason that I missed before. That scent means he was ahead of me, not that he's still there. Scent works like, well, I remember seeing old Charlie Brown comics, and there's this character called Pigpen drawn in a constant floating cloud of dirt. That's us, except the cloud is hair, dead skin, and even breath particles, all of it laden with scent. Our scent floats downwind on the breeze. Once we walk away, it lingers there before drifting to the ground where it leaves a trail. I still smell Mason faintly on the wind, which means he was here but no longer is as his scent settles to the ground. I move forward with extreme care, tracking those tendrils of scent while looking and listening for anything that shouldn't be in this forest. I resist the temptation to drop to my knees and sniff. That makes me an easy target. After about 100 paces, I can no longer smell him. I've overshot. Somewhere nearby, he veered off, probably after he cried out. Now comes the tricky part where I do need to sniff check the ground. His sense too faint in the air to figure out exactly where he turned. I back up a few steps and look around. I'm in a small clearing, which makes this easier. I can see he isn't within attacking distance. I do a weird crouch walk, head bobbing up like a prairie dog's, as I check left and right for attack. I listen, too, even more than I look, my ears straining. It's oddly silent here, disquietingly so. People say the forest is quiet, but that's just because they aren't really listening. There's always noise, birds chirping, animals scampering. Right now, even the light breeze seems to have died, and it is unnervingly still. A predator is near. That's what silence means. The birds and the animals hold their breath, waiting for the danger to pass. Mason is near. He's a vampire. He can scoff at me for drawing what seems like a ridiculous conclusion, but it's the only one that fits. I have eliminated the impossible, so my conclusion, however improbable, must be the truth. This silence only supports it. The clearing was quiet even before I entered, meaning another predator preceded me. I find the spot where Mason's trail ends. Then I hit a problem. It doesn't go anywhere. He walked this far and stopped. He must have retraced his steps. He knows I can track him, so he's wisely backed up. After 50 feet, I realize I'm mistaken. There is no way Mason perfectly backtracked that far over his own trail. It's like drawing a line, taking the paper away, and trying to draw the exact same line again. There will be deviations, yet this trail runs straight. I return to where it stopped, and I sniff around. But his trail literally stops dead. I squint up. The nearest overhanging branch is 10 feet to my left and another 10 off the ground. No supernatural could spring into the air and grab it. There are other scents, deer, rabbits, fox, and other small animals. No bear, though. No humans. Nothing spooked Mason. He stopped, let out an exclamation and a bellow of pain, and then vanished. Was I wrong about his supernatural type? I'd wondered earlier whether he could be a teleporting half-demon. That would explain the quick movements in our room. It would also explain this. He stops, screams for my benefit, and then teleports. Most supernaturals come into their powers post-puberty. For spellcasters, their powers kick in right around that time, and by our age, trained ones can cast decent spells, like Holly with her fireball. Necromancers start seeing ghosts around the same age. Werewolves are slower, with their secondary skills ramping up in adolescence and then culminating with their first change around adulthood. Half-demons show sporadic power bursts in their early teens, but it's a slow build. Which is the long way of saying that if Mason is a teleporting half-demon, he can't have gone far. There are 3 levels of teleporting half-demons, depending on their demon sire. At the lowest level, your dad was just some minor demon, probably not even in our records. At the highest level, in Abeo, your father was a lord demon. Even those guys aren't exactly transporting themselves halfway around the world. The lowest level, and most common subtype, can move a couple of feet, which sounds useless but makes them really hard to catch and hold. Demonology is a fascinating subject, and as may be obvious, I can go on about it at length. The short version is that, at best, Mason could teleport 50 feet once he reached his full strength. I hunt in ever-widening circles around his last known point. 5 feet, then 10, then 20. And when I hit 40, I know something's wrong. There's no way a teenage half-demon teleported this far. When I'm 50 feet away from the point of origin, I smell blood. I go still and sample the air. It's definitely blood, enough that I can smell it upwind. I also smell Mason. I lunge. Ready to run. Then I pull up short, which makes me feel like the biggest asshole ever. But I don't trust the guy. So I proceed at a quick walk, surveying while listening and sniffing. I see and hear nothing. I smell blood, though, and I smell Mason. The smell coming stronger until I spot Mason lying flat on his back in another clearing. I stop, my breath coming fast, as I gulp deep breaths to calm down. It could be a trick. It's probably a trick. Be careful. I approach one step at a time. At first, all I can see is a figure lying on the ground, almost hidden by the tall grass. It's the smell that tells me who it is. I spot swatches of clothing and sneakers pointed at the sky, telling me he's lying supine. It's not until I'm barely a few feet away that I see the blood. Blood covers his face and soaks his shirt, and I know then this is no trick. He's lying flat on his back, eyes closed, face and clothing covered in blood. I race over and drop beside him. My hands fly to his neck, and I can't find a pulse. I know there was one earlier. Now there is not. No pulse. No heartbeat, no breathing. Mason mocked me earlier for calling him a vampire when he was very obviously alive. He isn't anymore.
Chapter 12. Kate.
Werewolf. I breathe, the word coming on an exhale as I step back from Elijah. You're a werewolf. He rubs a hand over his face, as if still dazed from the kiss. That's why you're using that god-awful body spray. To cover your scent. I back up another step. I saw you earlier, before we met. You walked out of your room, spotted me, and bolted back inside. You recognized me. Then you sprayed on that shit and strolled out to make an impression. The kind of impression designed to send me running the other way every time I saw you. He glances down at his shirt, points at it, and offers a weak, "Team half-demon?" I sock him in the arm, hard enough to make him yelp. That's how you heard the counselor coming before I did. That's how you heard me when I thought I was being quiet. And you broke open the office door, didn't you? It wasn't conveniently unlocked. Great. Just great. Logan and I are here to prove werewolves aren't muscle-bound brutes, and you are not going to help the cause. Can you say anything other than, He hesitates, and then thrusts out a hand. I'm Elijah. The werewolf. I don't usually introduce myself like that, but... He leans against the wall, all practiced nonchalance. No law against being a werewolf. How about the one against misrepresenting yourself to Pack? His eyes roll. No such thing. Nice try, though. I know the laws, and I've never even bent one. Sure, because you haven't started changing yet. Those mahogany eyes narrow, as if I've insulted him. Your werewolf scent is faint. You'll notice mine is strong. I've been changing since I was 9. He crosses his arms. Not possible. I shrug. I'm a prodigy. Now, about hiding from me? I wasn't hiding. I was avoiding putting myself in the crosshairs of a pack wolf. For the same reason I won't drive my mom's BMW. After getting pulled over twice in the first month, I decided it wasn't worth the hassle. If you don't cause trouble, we don't hassle you. If you've heard otherwise, then I'd appreciate the chance to clear that up. Right now, though, the problem is that you're misrepresenting yourself to the camp, too, pretending to be a half-demon. Let me guess. You told them you just haven't come into your powers yet. Technically true. I knew they wouldn't let in a werewolf, so I lied, which is also not against pack law. Why are you here at all? He shrugs, leans against the wall again. It seemed cool. I thought it'd be nice to spend a week in the forest, especially when I'm so close to my first change. You do not want to be alone for that. A laugh sounds from down near the dining hall. We should move this conversation outside, I say. Better yet, help me find my brother. And we'll talk together. Or you can just drop the matter and let me go back to what I was doing. The computer is password protected. Unless you're a hacker. I catch his expression. You're a hacker. A game designer. With a little bit of hacking know-how. Well, you won't crack that password before the small group sessions break. I might be able to get you access to that computer another way, after you tell me why you want it. Now, let's go find my brother. And if I say no? I grab him by the t-shirt and start walking. I can slip out of the shirt, he says as he lets me drag him along. Please do, I say. I'd appreciate the scenery. He chokes on a laugh. You are not what I expected, Kate Danvers. Less judging, more moving. Logan isn't in his room. The scent pattern outside the door suggests he returned recently and left again. At that point, My hunt is delayed by Elijah, who wants to know how I can tell the scent is new. Your dad isn't in the picture, I presume, I say. He tenses, eyes darkening as his voice chills.
What makes you presume that?
Tracking scents is the kind of thing your father should have taught you, so I'm guessing he didn't stick around. He wouldn't be the first werewolf to do that. It's against the laws, though. If you father a son, you can't let him grow up without knowing what he is. What'll he do, send you a letter? We had a pack member whose dad did that. Asshole move, if you ask me. He tenses again, but this time, his voice doesn't chill.
My father told me what I am, but he wasn't around to teach me. He died when I was 5.
I rise, wiping my hands on my jeans. Shit, I'm sorry.
He knew it was coming, so he wrote notes explaining everything I'd need for when I got older. My mom and I were prepared.
Your mom knew what he was?
Yes, and before you say it, he knew that was against the laws. He didn't tell her. He was shot while in wolf form. Someone found him in the forest and called the local veterinarian, thinking he must be a huge dog. The local vet is my mom. She treated him in wolf form and put him into a kennel, planning to call the wildlife services in the morning.
And the next morning, she arrived to find a naked guy in that kennel?
You got it. Dad tried to escape. Mom knocked him out with a shot of ketamine. Then she interrogated him.
Interrogated?
Mom's kind of kick-ass, even if she doesn't have supernatural powers. No one was going to stand in the way of her solving that mystery. Dad eventually confessed, and they lived happily ever after. Well, happily for a couple of years, and then I came along unexpectedly. Mom figured she was too old for kids. Dad was even older, and when I was 4, he started having heart problems. He knew he didn't have much time, so he wrote notes for me and made some videos. What I don't have, though, is access to other werewolves to ask questions about things like scent trails.
But if your mom's human and you don't know other werewolves, how'd you end up at a camp for supernaturals?
You answer my questions and I'll answer yours. You got the fatherhood one free.
I nod. Fair enough. You can ask your questions later. First, I want to find my brother.
Maybe he joined one of the small group sessions. I think I hear them getting out now.
He's right. Footsteps sound overhead, enough to suggest the groups are indeed breaking. We head down the hall and up the stairs. Elijah's making no move to ditch me now, and he follows at my heels as I move fast, dodging the exiting campers, looking for familiar faces. Finally, I spot one down the hall. Holly, I call as we draw near. She perks up and looks over. I lead Elijah to her. Holly looks from him to me and murmurs,
I thought you went looking for your brother.
Found something better, I see. She figures Elijah won't hear over the din, but his enhanced hearing means he does, and he stifles a chuckle. Fortunately, she misses that. I do a quick intro and then ask whether she's seen Logan. She hasn't, but she stops a few people to inquire. Of course, that turns into Holly needing to introduce me, and then people looking from me to Elijah, working at our connection. No one has seen Logan, though. When I spot Alan, I ask him.
I haven't, he says. Is he missing?
Not really.
Not really?
I'm just trying. Someone cuts between us, blocking my answer. When the kid passes, Alan waves us down into the dining hall where we can speak more easily. Getting there makes me feel like a salmon fighting its way upstream. When we emerge in the dining hall, we pause to catch our breath.
What the hell?
A voice says. The brunette from earlier springs from the hallway crush. Mackenzie. Two of her hangers-on trail after her, both fixing me with self-satisfied smirks.
What the hell? Mackenzie repeats, because obviously she didn't enunciate dramatically enough the first time. The question seems to be directed at me. Is she wondering why I'm still here after I've revealed I'm actually a ravenous killing machine? She strides over and plants herself in front of Elijah instead. Then, she looks from me to him and repeats, "What the hell?" Her voice rising to a trill at the end. Elijah inches closer to me and says casually,
"Hey, Mackenzie, what's up?"
"What's up is that I just overheard Trisha telling another counselor that she saw you and her," she jabs her chin my way, "making out in the counselor's hall." Alan masks his laugh with a sudden coughing fit. Mackenzie glares at him. Then she crosses her arms and steps up to Elijah. "Tell me Trisha was mistaken." Elijah shrugs.
"Sorry."
His arm goes around my waist, pulling me against him so fast I stumble into his side.
"We were hoping to keep it on the down low for a while, get settled in before we let everyone know we're together, but..."
He shrugs. His hand moves around my shoulders and he toys with one of my curls.
"We couldn't help ourselves."
Mackenzie skewers me with a lethal gaze, spins on her heel, and stomps off. Her flunkies both give me a once-over and a dismissive sniff before following. When they're out of earshot, I spin on Elijah. He backs off fast, hands rising as if to avoid a blow, but instead I bounce and squeal, "OMG, Elijah, are you asking me to be your fake girlfriend? That is the sweetest." I trail off and frown. "Wait, I don't remember you asking. You just presumed I want a fake boyfriend."
He says, "Shit, I'm sorry, I wasn't thinking."
He pauses and then looks at me, brow rising hopefully.
"Do you want a fake boyfriend? Might not be a bad idea. It's hookup central here, and it's barely been 24 hours since the conference started. Hormones gone wild. It's crazy."
So says the guy who just made out with a total stranger on the flimsiest of pretenses. "I'm not looking for a hookup," I say, "or a romance of any kind." Elijah grins.
"Excellent. Then it's settled. I'll be your fake boyfriend. You'll be my fake girlfriend. Everyone's happy."
His arm goes back around my shoulders. I pluck it off. "There's no one here except two people who know we aren't actually dating." "Did Trisha really catch you two making out?" Holly says. "Accidentally," I say. Alan snorts a laugh so hard he doubles over. "Caught accidentally?" Holly says with a smile. "Or made out accidentally?" "We intended to be caught," I say. "That was the point. We were someplace we shouldn't be, and there was no escape, so we pretended to be there looking for a quiet place to make out. And then we ended up actually making out." "Accidentally," Holly says through sputtered laughter. "It happens," I say. "Only to you, I think," Holly says. "I'm not judging. A little jealous, maybe, but not judging."
"Did I miss something?" Elijah says.
"Holly?" someone says, coming in from the hall. It's a girl I don't recognize. She smiles at me and then turns to Holly. "Did I hear you were looking for the new guy?" "Kate's brother," Holly says, nodding to me. "Yes. I saw him earlier. I ran down to my room to grab my notebook, and when I came back, he was heading out the back doors. I noticed because he's..." Her cheeks redden as she sneaks a furtive glance at me. "One of the girls pointed him out at dinner, so I noticed him leaving." We thank her. Once she's gone, Elijah says,
"See what I mean? It's like real-life Tinder here. You can't walk 5 feet without someone checking you out.
I pat his back. That's just you. But don't worry. Your werewolf fake girlfriend will keep you safe from raging hormones. Except maybe mine. Now let's go see what trouble Logan's gotten himself into.
You think he's in trouble?
Holly says. No, but we can always hope. It's been a long day, and I am in need of an adventure.
Chapter 13. Logan. Mason is dead. He's lying on the ground, covered in blood, and he's dead. No heartbeat, no pulse, no breathing. He's still warm, though, and blood trickles from his nose. That's the only source of blood I see. It's a lot, far more than his earlier nosebleed, but it all seems to come from there with no obvious signs of injury. I've taken first aid. If a pack brother goes down, we need to treat him until we can get him to Jeremy. Kate hopes to fill the role of pack doctor one day, but for now, Jeremy is our medic. Kate has learned all that she can from him, and I've sat in on every lesson. Now, finding Mason still warm with no sign of what stopped his heart, my brain switches into paramedic mode. His heart has stopped very recently, which means there's a possibility of reviving him. I open his mouth and check inside. There's blood here, too, but it comes from a gash inside his cheek, as if he bit it. There's no sign of vomit or stomach bile. I clear the blood, and then I set him down, making sure he's flat and stable. I have to be careful with chest compressions, so, in my panic, I don't use more strength than necessary. Otherwise, I could crush his ribs. I count off 30 compressions and then switch to rescue breathing. Under normal circumstances, someone like me, not a medical professional, would stick to chest compressions and wait for help. But there's no ambulance coming, and it's highly unlikely there would be when I'm trying to resuscitate a down pack brother, so I'm trained in rescue breathing. I tilt Mason's head back and put my mouth to his and breathe into his lungs, pull back for 30 more chest compressions, and then press my mouth firmly to his, give 2 more breaths, and Mason's eyes open. Or I presume they do because I'm too busy to be looking. I see a flicker at the edge of my vision, and then he gasps. I pull back, and he flails, shoving me hard.
What the?
He says, breath raspy.
What the hell?
Before I can respond, he hits me, his fists slamming into my chest as I'm already backing away.
What the hell were you doing?
He snarls.
Bringing you back to life, asshole.
I back out of swinging range and glower at him. I'm not into necrophilia. He blinks, as if processing that. Making out with a dead guy, I say. We call that necro.
I know what the word means,
he snaps.
You were
administering CPR after finding you dead on the ground.
Dead?
No heartbeat, no pulse. No breathing. We call that dead. His face spasms with sheer panic.
No,
he whispers.
No, no, no.
His gaze flies to mine, his eyes round and terror-filled.
Am I breathing now? Is my heart?
He pats his chest, eyes widening even more when he doesn't find what he's searching for. The guy is sitting up, talking and moving and wondering whether he's actually alive. The obvious answer should be that he's mocking me. But the look in his eyes is unmistakably terror, and there is only one reason he'd be asking this, one reason he might think he was sitting up, conscious and yet not alive. With that, I get the answer to my question, one I hadn't considered because it doesn't quite make sense. It's the only logical solution, though. I don't confront him with that. The guy is freaking out, and I would never be so cruel. I'll get my answers later. He needs his answers first. Are you breathing? I say. His gaze locks on mine again, and his eyes narrow with a flicker of the mace.